Thanks for tuning in to WNCW. I'm Martin Anderson. Oh, we get a lot of great musicians on the air here at WNCW, down in Studio B or here in the air studio where I am. Sometimes we get to talk with folks that really know some of these musical legends, and that is the case this morning with Bill Kopp, an author out of Asheville. He writes for the Mountain Express, has for a number of years, and he has a new book that is just now coming out, Reinventing Pink Floyd, From Syd Barrett to the Dark Side of the Moon. Bill, welcome to WNCW.
Thank you, Martin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for making the drive down. And you are doing a bunch of readings of this new book. Congratulations on it, by the way.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that.
It's your first book. You've done a lot of writings for various journals and blogs, but is it your first book?
First one, yes.
Right. How's it feel?
It's surreal.
It is. Okay. Yeah.
I'm having a good time.
Good, good. It came together this past year, a rather short window as far as writing epic books is concerned.
Right. I began writing in May and worked on it through the summer and turned it in the fall. Although, to be fair, the ideas in the book had been knocking around in my head for decades.
I would imagine. Yeah. I can tell from reading through myself that you are definitely a fan of Pink Floyd. You know, sometimes someone will write a book focusing on a topic and, okay, it's maybe a good book, but you can tell that they're kind of new to the rodeo of this particular act. But no, you seem to know the band pretty well, and you're a musician yourself. I find this a good focus on the music more than a lot of other Pink Floyd, I guess, biographies, which is really more biographical, more about the personalities and the soap opera, the drama. Your book touches on everything, but it's a good spotlight on the actual songs, which is what we love Pink Floyd for, right?
Absolutely. And that's really what I wanted to focus on. There have been, as you say, plenty of other books that have focused more on the personalities and that sort of thing. And I really wanted to bring the focus back to what's going to endure, and that's the music.
Yeah. And you focused on an era of Pink Floyd that has maybe been overlooked. When people mention Pink Floyd, people think of The Wall, which was, 1979?
79, right.
Yeah, right. A little disco influence on that one. And, of course, Dark Side of the Moon. And then some folks know about Syd Barrett. But what about that period between when Syd Barrett, the founding member, one of them anyway, and the front man, the guitarist, and the chief songwriter for Pink Floyd, what about when he left in 1968? There does seem to be a gap in our knowledge of Pink Floyd between that time and then 1973 with Dark Side of the Moon.
That's right. Most people don't realize that Dark Side of the Moon was actually Pink Floyd's eighth album. So they did a lot of work in those intervening years. And once Syd was gone, they were in many ways creatively set adrift, because, as you say, he was the primary songwriter. And so they had to find their way. It was an interesting time in music they were signed to a major label, Harvest, and expected to put out another album. And with their chief songwriter gone, they had to just sort of figure out, well, what do we do now? And those experiments led inexorably, really, to Dark Side of the Moon over the course of 5 years. With the benefit of hindsight, I think you can look at pretty much everything they did between 68 and 72 and see it as a step in the direction, although they didn't know it at the time, it was in the direction of making the Dark Side of the Moon.
And yeah, like you touched on, it seemed like most bands probably would have folded when someone who is the singer, maybe kind of the creative spark behind the band, and certainly the songwriter, when he leaves, well, you know, what's a band going to do? They're going to maybe start over again. But I guess for whatever reason, they decided to keep on going. A lot of folks think of Roger Waters as being sort of the reason, the linchpin of the sound of early Pink Floyd after Syd Barrett. It's as if Roger Waters took over. Well, maybe he did sort of as the kind of man who had the plan to keep things going, but from my reading of your material and some of the other stories of early Pink Floyd, it was really the introduction of David Gilmour as a guitarist to replace Syd Barrett's guitar work that really helped solidify the chances of Pink Floyd continuing.
True. Gilmour was brought in January of 68, not to replace Syd, but to sort of back him up as the second guitarist. They did exist as a five-piece for a few weeks at the most. But Gilmour's charge initially was to play like Syd. Just a cursory listen to pretty much anything that Pink Floyd did after Syd Barrett illustrates that they had very, very different approaches to their instruments. And so that took them in a different direction. And while what you said about Roger Waters is certainly true in the big picture, during those intervening years, during those 5 years, the fact that they worked collaboratively, the four of them, maybe not exactly divided up equally, but the fact that they worked as a team, so to speak, has more to do with the creative success of what they came up with. And I would argue that had they not had that sort of collective working together spirit during those years, they would not have eventually been able to come up with The Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah. We're talking with Bill Kopp, an author of his new book of these early years of Pink Floyd. I know you're giving a reading tomorrow night in Asheville at Malaprops. That's at 6 o'clock for this new book. And then you have another one or two in the area?
Right. I've got Saturday, March 10 at 2 p.m. at Fiction Addiction in Greenville. Thursday, March 15th at 7 p.m. at Park Road Books in Charlotte. And then Saturday, March 16 at 7 p.m. at Hub City Books in Spartanburg. That is my quote-unquote book tour.
Yeah, all right. You're covering all of the Western Carolinas. Anyway,
right.
Cool. Bill Kopp here at WNCW. Let's jump into some of this music, and why don't we begin with early Pink Floyd, early enough that we include Syd Barrett in here and one of a couple of singles that they released before their first album, huh?
Right. See Emily Play, which was a big influence on a lot of artists that came afterwards. It's a track from 1967, which is the same time period when Sgt. Pepper came out and when the Moody Blues Days of Future Past came out. So it's of that era.
All right. WNCW.
Emily tries, but misunderstands. She's often inclined to borrow somebody's dreams till tomorrow. There is no other day. Let's try it another way. You'll lose your mind and play. Free games play. See Emily play. Soon after dark, Emily cries. Gazing through trees in sorrow, hardly a sound till tomorrow. Gown that touches the ground. Float on a river forever and ever, Emily. There is no other day. Let's try it another way.
See Emily Play from Pink Floyd. That and Arnold Lane were the first two singles released by Pink Floyd back in 1967. My name is Martin, talking with Bill Kopp, an author of a new book about these early years of Pink Floyd. And Bill, there is a great example of Syd Barrett, the frontman for Pink Floyd, and one of the tunes he wrote. When people ask, how would you describe Syd Barrett's songwriting? You know, what sets him apart? He was really seen by a lot of songwriters back in the day, people part of the psychedelic scene, as just absolutely brilliant.
Very much so. Very much so. He, his approach, basically he had two, to sort of categorize it, he had two general approaches to songwriting. One were the sort of whimsical pop songs with a lot of sort of childlike imagery. He wrote songs, a song about a scarecrow, a song about a gnome, a song about a bicycle, you know, those sort of things, all sort of filtered through the sort of psychedelic mindset, if you will. And then the other kind of songs that he wrote were more sort of extended freeform, I hesitate to use the word jam, but a little more musical, open and, free form, I guess you'd say. And one of the best examples of that is a tune called Interstellar Overdrive, which is on their first album, which runs 7-8 minutes or more.
Which was pretty unheard of back in the day, or pretty innovative anyway, at least outside of jazz circles
right.
In America. Yeah, I did read, was it in your book, I guess, did you touch on how Syd himself and maybe other members of the band kind of not confessed, but admitted or acknowledged that there are kind of two different aspects to our band. There is what we do in the studio, and there's what we do live.
Yeah, they're very, very different. I think if you heard those early Pink Floyd singles and even listened to the first album, you got one impression of the band, one idea of what they were like. And if you had seen them live, which of course I didn't because we're talking about 1967 here, what you experienced was something quite different. There have been there are circulating a few bootlegs of the band from that period. When the box set, the early years, came out just under a year and a half ago, a couple of those finally got official release, and so the wider audience was able to hear them. The sound quality is actually really, really good, except that you can't hear any vocals. But it does give an idea of very much of what they sounded like live, and it was pretty wild. They didn't play the pop tunes at all in concert.
Yeah, and while they maybe got their start more or less as an R&B-inspired band, they pretty quickly shifted to the uniqueness that was Pink Floyd, and that was Syd Barrett really at the forefront. Certainly Roger Waters and the rest of the mates that joined in lent their part, but it sure seems like this was from the mind of Syd Barrett, which is a very unique mind, and bringing in interesting chord progressions that hadn't been done, weird time signature changes thrown in there, and you cover it very well in your book. It really touches, like I say, predominantly, I'd say, on the music itself. Syd Barrett, lots of tales of, he just had too much LSD, he lost his mind. No, it was schizophrenia. No, I hear a bandmate say, like, really, it was just that he did not want the limelight that they all of a sudden were getting, and he kind of got basically kind of stage fright, and so that's what made him retract. What say you? Is it kind of all of the above? Is it one catalyst?
I think it really is all of the above. I think the stage fright probably would be less than the other two. I don't know. It wasn't so much that. He was a deeply creative person, obviously. But, you know, as best as I can tell, he was never officially diagnosed with any sort of particular mental illness, although in retrospect, it's widely assumed that he was suffering from schizophrenia, untreated schizophrenia, and he did drop a whole lot of LSD. The thing is, though, is I've been asked before, well, gosh, what would have happened had Syd not sort of floated off into the ether? What would Pink Floyd have been like had he stayed? And of course, it's pure speculation, but I think if he had stayed, he wouldn't have stayed long, because he basically more or less lost interest in music. He did make two solo albums, very much with the help of his former bandmates. But after that, he pretty much put his guitar down and channeled his creative energies into painting.
Right, right. So that's a whole other neat realm to get into, is the paintings of Syd Barrett. We're talking with Bill Kopp, author of this new book of Pink Floyd. And let's turn to more music. And now, chronologically, we turn to some recordings from Pink Floyd once Syd Barrett has moved on from the band, and Roger Waters and David Gilmour kind of at the helm here, with, of course, Nick Mason, Rick Wright, too. And talk about this tune that was maybe meant to be a hit single, but just wasn't.
The first thing they did, as we've said, they were a bit adrift once Syd was gone. They brought in David Gilmour, who was a superb guitarist, but who didn't have any track record with songwriting. They were trying to figure out what to do next. One of the things they said, well, let's try to write some more hit pop singles in the vein of Syd's style. And so, to the extent that it's that kind of a song, Point Me at the Sky is sort of almost a pastiche of Syd Barrett's songwriting style. It was not a hit. And for many, many years, unless you could find the original 45, that song was not officially available. In fact, it didn't become available again widely until a year and a half ago.
All right. Point Me at the Sky, early Pink Floyd here on NCW.
Hey, Gene, this is Henry McLean, and I've finished my beautiful flying machine, and I'm ringing to say that I'm leaving, and maybe you'd like to fly with me and hide with me, baby. Isn't it strange how little we change? Isn't it sad we're insane? Playing the games that we know end in tears, the games we've been playing for thousands and thousands and thousands. I hope you're exceedingly thin. For if you are stout, you will have to breathe out while the people around you breathe in, breathe in.
Point me at the sky.
That's Point Me at the Sky from Pink Floyd here at WNCW. Talking with Bill Kopp, author of the new book about Pink Floyd. Support for programming here comes from Frugal Backpacker, a locally owned and independent outdoor store specializing in new arrivals and closeouts from Colombia, Patagonia, Prana, and more, with hiking suggestions and outdoor tips and tricks on its blog, with more at its store in Asheville's Westgate Plaza and online at frugalbackpacker.com. Also, the Broyhill Civic Center in Lenoir, North Carolina, welcoming the Victor Wooten Trio Friday, April 6th at 7:30. Information and tickets at broyhillcenter.com. And we get support from Oscar Blues Brewery, presenting the Loaded Up and Truckin' Food Truck Competition and Oral Pleasure Festival, with live music from Donna the Buffalo, River Wireless, and more at the Reeb Ranch, April 14th. Camping passes available. Tickets at loadedupandtruckin.com. WNCW is a media sponsor. We're spending this hour talking about Pink Floyd with author Bill Kopp, who has a wonderful new book about these early years of Pink Floyd, Reinventing Pink Floyd, From Syd Barrett to the Dark Side of the Moon. Thanks for coming in, Bill. And we should mention your website for folks that can't make it to one of these readings you're doing.
That's reinventingpinkfloyd.com.
Okay. Easy to remember.
Yep.
ReinventingPinkFloyd.com, and you're at Malaprops in Asheville tomorrow evening, and then you're in Greenville on Saturday at
2 p.m.
All right. What's that event?
Oh, it's Fiction Addiction.
All right, great. And then Charlotte next Thursday, and then Spartanburg the following
Saturday.
All right. And so we've covered there the 1968 transition of wondering if the band can survive in a post-Syd Barrett world, and they did, especially with the help of getting into the film world. Talk about that.
Right. From the very earliest days, Pink Floyd had an interest in, even though the term hadn't been coined yet, in multimedia, in combining sound and vision, so to speak. As early as 67, they did some soundtrack work for a film, Peter Whitehead film, called Tonight, Let's All Make Love in London. And then they took a sort of artsy, kind of silent, psychedelic film that a filmmaker had made, as filmmakers do. And they created some music to go with that. It was called John Latham. And then they did the soundtrack to an avant-garde film called The Committee. And then they kind of hit the sort of bigger time and started doing soundtrack work to order for major motion pictures. And the first one they did was a film called More. And so that while their third album is called More, in fact, More is really a soundtrack LP.
Okay, yeah. And their music certainly fit well with the film soundtracks. We should mention also, I was interested to learn that when we, the U.S., did one of our major lunar landings. Did not the BBC cover that on television? But in the periods in between, they used Pink Floyd performing live, I guess, at BBC studios, right?
That's right. The band went to BBC's television studios, and they were asked to sort of just jam while the essentially silent footage of the lunar landing was happening on screen. And so they made up music more or less on the spot. What's sort of amusing is that just a couple of years ago, David Gilmour wrote a short piece for The Guardian in which he recalled that session. And he says it was a pleasant enough little blues jam. We never did anything with that music after that, and nothing of any sort of a lasting value came out of it. It's interesting that he says that, because if you listen to the track, which is another one that has been released recently, it's called Moonhead, it sounds exactly like the middle section of Money.
Okay, yeah. Well, one thing I found that Pink Floyd did do is they kind of didn't really... Well, they experimented with all sorts of things, obviously, and they often would save them and kind of come back to them.
That's
later
right.
On. Yeah. Ultimate recyclers.
Yes. Yeah. They never threw away a good idea. They didn't beat an idea to death, but they if they had any time they did something, they would learn from it. If it was a viewed as a failure, they would say, okay, well, let's go forward and not do that again. And if it was something that had value, they would take that and try to build upon it.
You're taking us to a riot scene now.
Right. It's a track from, the band recorded an entire album's worth of material for the director Michelangelo Antonioni, the guy who had done Blow Up just a few years earlier, and it was a film called Zabriskie Point. There was a scene where juxtaposition of a really wild, violent riot happening on the screen, and the music that they wrote, which was actually written by keyboardist Richard Wright, was designed to stand in stark contrast with that. For whatever reason, Antonioni ended up not using the music that Pink Floyd created, that he used one or two songs. But I think a quick listen to the riot scene, which is a brief piece, that too will sound familiar to modern day listeners.
That is a short piece from Pink Floyd from 1969, you say, Bill. It's called The Riot Scene. And boy, that does sound familiar. And it's funny, we were just talking about how they had their ideas, and if they didn't work at the time, they held on to it to use it later. And, of course, people are thinking, okay, that sounds familiar. When did they use that?
Well, with lyrics added by Roger Waters, that became a song called Us and Them, which is one of the highlights of The Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah. And as we move now into the 70s here in our exploration of Pink Floyd here with Bill Kopp about his new book. And I mentioned that they were used to provide the soundtrack for viewing the lunar landing. And they certainly became associated with outer space exploration, certainly Dark Side of the Moon part of it. And it's interesting to me. It seems like during the early eras of Sid Barrett, it was all about exploring inner space, you know, the wild mind of Sid and the rest of the guys in that psychedelic scene. And what was it? What was the catalyst that made them so affiliated and associated with the exploring outer space?
I think it was just the times, really. In fact, they were never really comfortable with the idea of being a quote-unquote space rock band. There are certainly elements in that in their music. A lot of that, I think, had to do with the fact that much of their music during that 5-year interval was kind of impressionistic, and a lot of it was either completely instrumental or largely instrumental, other than the stuff that they did for soundtracks, which sometimes would have lyrics.
And it also seemed like the music of the songs of Pink Floyd, in terms of mood, went maybe from more of kind of a dark, sinister side of them in their early years to a little more of like a sort of a pastoral and light, warm era, kind of more evoking maybe Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, maybe Traffic. I guess that was just sort of the songwriting differences of Roger Waters and David Gilmour.
Yeah, I think so. A lot of David Gilmour stuff tended to be a little more sort of based in an English folk idiom, even though he's got a background as a blues guitarist. So yeah, I think it was really the collective input of all four of them. Rick Wright had a jazz background. So all those things kind of came together in their music.
Yeah, and they certainly would return to the dark, sinister side now and again as well, certainly on The Wall, but also on Dark Side of the Moon. That riot scene, well, a name like Riot Scene, that doesn't sound pastoral and sweet and warm, but it's such a beautiful little melody, that is. But then come the words, it's about us and them, and you know, talking about fascism and disparity, and a lot of heavy themes in Dark Side of the Moon. As we get to around 1973, when Dark Side of the Moon was released, but in 1972, you say, during the sessions were in which they recorded Dark Side of the Moon, they also recorded an album, Obscured by Clouds.
Right. A quick chronology. In January of 72, the band rented some warehouse space and began rehearsing and routining new material for their stage show. At the time, that work, of that collection of songs, was called Eclipse, A Piece for Assorted Lunatics. And eventually that became The Dark Side of the Moon. By late January 72, they were performing that. There are actually several dozen bootleg performance tapes of them performing the embryonic Dark Side of the Moon prior to the album coming out. About halfway through the sessions for Dark Side of the Moon, which they would do when they were not playing shows, they picked up another work-for-hire gig, once again for the director, Barbe Schrader. So the band took, I believe it was about 2 weeks, went to a studio in France and recorded the songs that would be released as Obscured by Clouds. Then they went back to London, did some more shows, continued to play the Dark Side, the pre-Dark Side material live, along with some of the Obscured by Clouds tracks live. Then they finished recording Dark Side, and then they released Dark Side. So they, throughout their history, they have lots of examples of the band really working material out live on stage and doing things in a different order than that they would come out. And so Obscured by Clouds certainly falls into that category.
And here is the title track to that. It's WNCW. We'll be right back.
turn to rust. All the proud men turn to dust. And so all things time will mend. And so this song will end.
Listening to a piece called Moonhead that I think you just mentioned a little bit ago, Bill. Moonhead from Pink Floyd on WNCW.
Right. That's Pink Floyd jamming live to the moon landing, 1969.
Cool. And yeah, that bass line sure sounded familiar.
Yep. Once again, Pink Floyd's a band that never threw away an idea.
Yeah. And before that, Childhood's End from Obscured by Clouds. And yeah, that certainly gives us a taste of where they went with Dark Side and Beyond. Talking with Bill Kopp, author of a wonderful new book about these early years of Pink Floyd. You can find out more about it through his website, reinventingpinkfloyd.com. Bill's giving a talk tomorrow evening at Malaprops in Asheville. And then you're also doing one for friends in Greenville on Saturday and Charlotte next Thursday. And then on Saturday the 16th, you come to Spartanburg. Again, you can follow him through reinventingpinkfloyd.com. Bill, your goal in this book was what?
Well, the idea is that the Dark Side of the Moon, for what an important landmark album it is, didn't create itself out of nothing. And the idea is to just show people how they got there, how they went from that period in 68 when they were creatively adrift to creating such an enduring work in the space of 5 short years. And it's basically, if someone comes out of the experience of reading the book wanting to go back and listen to that material and discover it for themselves, then I feel like I've succeeded.
Good, good. All right, then. We'll touch on a little more Pink Floyd, and then maybe we'll touch a little bit on Pink Floyd's lasting impact in new music today. We've got a really new album, neat new album from who is it? I'm just forgetting who.
Jonathan Wilson.
From Mr. Wilson, Jonathan yeah. Wilson, who is actually from the Spindle Forest City area, and he's been, yes, he is, and he did the guitar work with Roger Waters on tour recently, has a wonderful new album, but you have a little more Pink Floyd fun for us with a tune, another obscure one, not obscured by clouds, but Stars Die. You want to talk about that?
Well, that's Porcupine Tree. That's That's another band that was very much influenced by Pink Floyd. In fact, progressive rock fans will be familiar with the name Stephen Wilson. He has, in addition to leading Porcupine Tree and a number of other projects, Blackfield, on and on, he's got a thriving solo career and a pretty big sideline doing remixes of classic albums from the progressive era. He's done stuff by King Crimson, Jethro Tull, Gentle Giant, on and on and on.
Yeah. Now, a lot of folks are familiar with progressive rock, prog rock, like King Crimson and Yes, and then sometimes people debate whether Pink Floyd really was a prog rock band or not. They did their long, expansive tunes. They were really experimental, but maybe not.
They certainly had elements of progressive rock, but their emphasis was a little more on atmospheric, almost ambient kind of things, as opposed to the sort of showcasing the technical virtuosity that you might find in a Chris Squire bass line on Close to the Edge or something like that.
Yeah, well said. So here's Porcupine Tree and Stars Die on NCW.
Gentle fire, the ocean glazed, and melted wire, voices buzzed, in spiral eyes, stars dived in blinding skies. Bridges broke, and windows sighed. Cells grew up, rivers burst, sound obscured and sense reversed.
That is Porcupine Tree and Stars Die here at WNCW.
Join us every Wednesday night, Thursday morning at 1 on WNCW for Floydian Slip, an hour of Pink Floyd. Hey, I'm Craig Bailey, your host for an hour of Pink Floyd. Floydian Slip, Wednesday night, Thursday mornings at 1, right here on WNCW.
Hey, that's coming up tonight after our Jar of Jam. I think it's great to have a little Pink Floyd spotlight following our Grateful Dead spotlight. Certainly the two commingled to some extent. They knew of each other a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah, talking with Bill Kopp here as we wrap up our hour of Pink Floyd, the early years, and spending a little time with some bands that have gotten together in the wake of this wonderful zenith of power of Pink Floyd, Porcupine Tree, and now this guitarist here, Jonathan Wilson, and a wonderful new release that we just got here. It's called Rare Birds. Jonathan Wilson has been on tour with Roger Waters lately, and has this new one, Rare Birds. It's been a real pleasure talking with you, Bill, and picking your brain about all these different stories and songs behind Pink Floyd and all the different folks that you interviewed for your book, including Craig Bailey, host of Floydian Slip.
That's right. He had a lot of interesting things to say about his ideas on the band's enduring popularity and you know what makes them special. And he would know because he's as immersed in this material as I am, at least.
Well, what's your next book going to be?
I'm working on a couple different ideas. Nothing to announce quite yet. I'm hoping to go out to L.A. in a couple weeks and start work on the next one. We'll see. It won't be about Pink Floyd, though.
It won't.
I'm going to go in a completely different direction. Still about music, certainly. But to be announced.
Okay. Meanwhile, working with Mountain Express. Look forward to your next articles and such in Mountain Express and elsewhere, and we can follow you through your website, at least for this book, reinventingpinkfloyd.com. Have fun with your readings coming up here in Asheville and Greenville and Charlotte and Spartanburg, respectively. Keep them busy during your big Southeast tour.
That's right.
Of early Pink Floyd.
That's right.
Bill Kopp, thanks again.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is new music from Jonathan Wilson, Trafalgar Square, and you can hear a bit of his Floydian influence on this album, Rare Birds. I'm Martin Anderson, and it's WNCW Spindale, WSIF Wilkesboro. Thanks again to Bill Kopp for spending the hour with me here as a guest DJ. DJ Scotty Robertson is up next with an afternoon of music, including a spoonful of blues coming your way and a real interesting one from New Tunes at Two. It is a fiery one from Daddy, Will Kimbrough, and Tommy Womack. A very contemporary release that might go with some themes that you'll hear in the news headlines from NPR coming your way. Thanks for joining us.